You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
There was a tense political climate in Paris in 1938, 2 years before the German invasion of France, and it's the setting of best-selling author Alan Furst's latest historical spy novel, which follows an Austrian emigre who's become a popular Hollywood actor currently in Paris to shoot a World War I-themed film. Naturally, he ends up spying for the U.S. and Germany. Mission to Paris is published by Random House, and I'm very pleased that it brings Alan Furst back to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Frederick Stahl, your protagonist, is one of those foreign-born actors who was so popular in Hollywood in the 30s. I started going through a list, and I realized that a lot of them,
huge.
Charles Boyer, Paul Henry, Peter Lorre, Marie Chevalier, Marlene Dietrich, Greta Garbo. But it's my sense that you were thinking of Cary Grant when you created this character.
I was thinking of Frederick March.
Oh, were you?
Yeah.
Who was not an immigrant.
Not at all. He's from Ohio. But curious.
Well, that is an immigrant, isn't it?
Where am I today? Oh, New York. Yes, I guess so. I was thinking in part of Cary Grant in terms of accent. Mm-hmm. Because Cary Grant's accent is the most amazing thing. It doesn't come from anywhere. He contrived to speak this wonderful East Coast sophisticated language that no one else spoke that.
Maybe Katharine Hepburn in a different way. She also had an accent that seemed to be unique to her.
Yes, but she has a very upper class accent. Cary Grant was more like a gent, mm-hmm. if I can use a word.
So here we have this an actor who has pretty much lost his Austrian accent. But it's still there as a right. as a little under.
Right. It's become a continental accent.
Didn't you live in as an American abroad in Paris for some time? Did your experiences inform Frederick's experiences as an emigre? Is it the same thing to live in a foreign place, whether you are an American there or somebody else here?
I think it's quite different. For one thing, his career was in America. For another thing, it was a refuge for him in Hollywood, as it was for all those people, from Hedy Lamarr, fellow Austrian, right on through the rest of the people you mentioned. And the Hollywood, the people who ran Hollywood, moguls at that time, they really were, loved these people. They were talented. They were interesting. They were sexy. And it was like an exotic thing for Americans to go to the movies and see these people.
And a lot of them, not just the actors. We had some of our greatest directors.
Fritz Lang,
Jean Renoir,
yes.
and many others who yeah. were all emigres from Hitler.
That's true.
You have Frederick on loan from an American studio that he works for, working on a movie called Après la Guerre. In France, what kind of political climate as an Austrian-American would he find there?
The political climate he finds is an incredibly tense left-right confrontation that followed what's called the Popular Front, which had a premier who was a Jew, Leon Blum, mm-hmm. I'll say it in either language. They used to write on the walls, Mir Hitler ke Blum, better Hitler than Blum, and they meant it. He was hauled from his car by a crowd and beaten almost to death in the middle of being the premier of France. I mean, they really hated him, and the right wing was at that time ferocious. They owned most of the newspapers and a lot of the radio stations for political purposes. So it was like a country in heavy, brutal political conflict to the advantage of their neighbor who was supported by the French right. They wanted Hitler, and they wouldn't mind that if France had signed a treaty with Hitler, giving Germany and Hitler a lot of power in France.
Well, since Austria had already been annexed by Germany in 1938, Frederick is entering a situation that might even be a little familiar to him, although he was long gone by this time.
He left a long time ago.
He doesn't seem to even care much about his family that he left behind.
He hates them. He's the guy who – he's the kid who ran away to sea when he was 16 years old. He's the artist or actor who's rejected by a middle-class family.
But is he concerned about how he might be received in France as an Austrian or in Germany as someone who's gone to America?
He doesn't think of himself as an Austrian as much as he thinks of himself as an actor. In other words, and I think he was supported in that. Remember, he had adopted France as his real country after he returns from having run away to sea. He returns after 1918 to Vienna, leaves there, goes to Paris, and in Paris, on the Left Bank, he makes his career in movies, starting with Silence and then moving to talkies.
You explore in depth the German network of influence within France that you were talking about. Their approach was to urge reconciliation instead of rearmament.
That's correct.
And were most people in France aware of this kind of political manipulation?
Most people in France. We're talking about a time when there was a literacy rate of about 30%, if that. So I think most people in France didn't think about it too much. What they didn't want, most people in France, is to have once again what amounted to the psychic trauma of World War I. That ruined the French. They never recovered from it. There were women in black war widows in every city. And because France is, you know, is always a Catholic country, widows wore black. No family was without an uncle with bad lungs from the gas, missing a foot, missing a hand, missing an arm. They couldn't deal with the
idea. They did not want another war.
No, they didn't want another war. They knew they couldn't win it because across the border, here are the Germans marching and chanting and singing and ready to rumble. And the French were afraid of them.
So Frederick does a publicity interview for the French newspaper Le Matin.
Right, a real newspaper at the time.
Yeah, and one that was leaning toward reconciliation with Germany.
A corrupt right-wing rag that counseled reconciliation with Germany rather than building fighter planes. Let's put things on that level.
Now, the French image since World War II has been that almost everyone was in the resistance. And I remember seeing Marcel Ophel's incredible documentary, which revealed that the great majority of the French were perfectly happy.
They weren't perfectly happy, but they weren't going to get involved in something like the resistance. But a lot of them did get involved in the resistance, quite more than you think. And it increased as the war went on, as it became clear that France was going to be on the winning side. You had a lot of people who joined the resistance. What were they called? I can't think of the word in French, but it means like, what is it that you prevent moths with? What's that stuff? Mothballs. Mm-hmm. But they referred to it by its chemical names, meaning that they had been sort of in storage in some kind of closet, and now they were coming out. Yeah, something like that.
Well, Frederick slowly takes up spy work for a diplomat at the American Embassy in France who claims that the spy network he works for takes its orders directly from President Roosevelt without the knowledge of Congress. Is that something that really occurred?
True story. America had no spy service, didn't want one.
This is before the creation of the OSS.
That's correct, which wasn't until 1942, quite late. Roosevelt needed information to persuade Congress to go to war, at least to persuade Congress to stop the Brits from being defeated. And so what he did was he used his rich friends. There's a book by Vincent Astor, who was a very wealthy man and a yachtsman, who went all over Europe in his yacht visiting dignitaries, visiting factories. William Donovan, who eventually led the OSS, went on a fact-finding trip for Roosevelt. So that's what Roosevelt did. So that's a real story.
Now, in many books of this sort, the protagonist is a tortured hero or an anti-hero, but you've made Frederick an honor-bound, upstanding citizen kind of hero, except perhaps
in his
sex life.
He's upstanding there as well.
You turned around to see the reaction.
I didn't know if that was okay. He's a very decent man. The reason he plays the Frederick March roles is that that is similar to his character. He's very decent, kind, understanding, sympathetic kind of person for whatever reason. We all grow as we grow. And but he can't tolerate Nazism. That sort of personality just shrivels when it is confronted by evil on that level.
But he's kind of like somebody whose real life character is not all that different from
That's correct.
The character he plays in
That's
the films.
Correct. That's correct.
And that's because they understand, the Hollywood moguls understand that about him and see that he's comfortable in that kind of role.
That's correct.
Do you think that foreign-born or foreign-looking stars are more popular in America than they are in other countries? Although I know Burt Lancaster was quite popular in Italy, made some great movies there. But
I think that's one of those things that would be hard to say. Someone once said to me, if you make a movie that can be shown in South America, it must have Ernest Borgnine. And I said, why Ernest Borgnine? Because to me it's Marty and a few other things. They said Ernest Borgnine packs the theaters in South America.
You have no idea why.
I have no idea why.
Superstar in South America.
Yeah.
Ethel Merman had other feelings about him. You have a restaurant in Paris that you put in every one of your novels?
That's correct.
It always Brasserie Heininger. Why?
It's a kind of touchstone. I use it in a particular way. It's common in Paris for people to have a favorite place, a canteen so-called, a place where they always go to have dinner. When it doesn't work out, they can have dinner at home. But the thing about the Brasserie Heininger is that so far, all 12 characters in my 12 books react to it in a completely different way. A young Bulgarian defector is enchanted with it, whereas a movie producer in The World at Night is told that he's got to meet someone there, and he says, oh, not that place, please. So it just depends.
But, of course, for your readers, they say, oh, we're back.
right.
Instead of having a recurring hero, you right. have a recurring brasserie.
That's correct.
The novel ends in January 1939. Now, we know what happened in the following years. Does that make it more difficult to create tension?
Easier.
In a book like this?
Easier. Far easier. Because you have someone say, well, in May of 40, we'll all be moving to our new house in the country. No, you won't. You'll be lucky to be alive. You'll be lucky not to be starving to death. But only we know that. So you can play the characters against the reader's knowledge. I think that's something historical novelists, if they don't do it, they ought to do it.
Your website calls your novels, starting with Night Soldiers, one very long book.
True.
Do you think of them that way?
Yes.
Even though like each one chapters. Has a different protagonist?
Each one has a different protagonist, but it's like one long big book.
Because in the end, they're all about the lead-up to World War II.
They are. They're about fascism. They're about what fascism did to Europe and how some of the people there reacted to it.
And there were real surprises. There was a very great French writer, Louis Ferdinand Céline, who turned out to be in support of the Nazis, to everyone's surprise, based on his work. And the French didn't know what to do with it because he may have been the second greatest writer the country produced after Proust in the 20th century.
He's a terrific writer, and I've always liked him, but I don't necessarily admit it. He was a terrible anti-Semite. He went on the radio and raved, and in 1944, after Normandy, he fled to Germany and didn't come back until the 50s. They would have hung him. They would have shot him, is what
yeah,
they would have done.
They finally allowed him back because they recognized that he was a great writer.
He is a great writer. There's no question
but
about
the,
it.
But my point here is that this is also the world you're writing about, where brilliant people can also be terrible people.
They can be terrible people.
Since all of these novels take place in roughly the same time period, by now you must be pretty familiar with everything that happened. Do you still have to do research?
I still have to do research. I still love to do research. The thing that gets me about this, and it has something to do with the multinational makeup of Europe, is that there are endless stories. It's endlessly fascinating. It's not just me. Turn on the History Channel. We fight the Second World War again every night, and we win every night, I'm glad to say. You know what I'm saying? It's internally fascinating to me. There's something about that period of time that's very, very rich for a novelist.
So do you think you'll ever write about any other time period?
I don't think so. I've never had the idea to do so. I certainly wouldn't write a contemporary novel. But I don't like other periods. I like this period.
And mostly in France.
In France, in Hungary, in Romania, each country has a totally different story. So when you're writing a novel about Romania, now you're writing a completely different novel than if you write one that takes place in Spain.
What about writing a work of nonfiction about the period?
I wouldn't be very good at that, I don't think. I'm not a footnote type guy.
Alan First will be reading and signing books tonight at 7 p.m. at the Upper East Side Barnes & Noble store. The book, Mission to Paris, his latest bestseller, published by Random House. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you for having me.